is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Sign up now for their virtual camp 2.0 featuring 10 days of workouts with pro trainers from the Dr. Dish family. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Vinny Falvo, creator of The Shoticle, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering new subscribers 10% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code SAVE10 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its play bank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
I'm really excited to come back to Michigan Tech and talk about a place that I love. It's a unique place, and just excited to work with the guys and have that team setting again and be with the players on a daily basis.
Ben Stelzer is an assistant men's basketball coach at Michigan Tech University, having been hired at his alma mater in June of 2021. From 2019 to 2021, Stelzer held the position of player development intern with the Dallas Mavericks, as well as Solid Base Skills and Drills website developer and owner, which provides remote player development training for players and teams from youth ages to college. Ben ran clinics with small groups of youth, high school, and college-level players from 2017 to 2019 as a skill development coach and was on the men's basketball staff at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh as an assistant men's basketball coach during their 2019 NCAA Division III National Championship run. Stelzer started his coaching career as an assistant coach at Michigan Tech during the 2016-2017 season after playing professionally in Spain following his collegiate career. At MTU, Ben was a four-year starter and three-year captain. He finished as the program's all-time leader in three-pointers made and was named an NCAA Division II All-American, Academic All-American, and Midwest Region Player of the Year. He led the Huskies to three NCAA tournament appearances and a trip to the NCAA Division II Sweet 16. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Grab your pen and paper so you're ready to listen to this episode with Ben Stelzer, assistant men's basketball coach at Michigan Tech University. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast assistant coach at Michigan Tech University, Ben Stelzer. Ben, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
Thanks, Mike. It's a pleasure to be on.
We are excited to be able to have you on. You have a very interesting and diverse background in the game of basketball and have done things in a lot of areas where we've had guests that have maybe been in one of these areas, but you've been in a number of different positions, not only as a basketball player, but also as a basketball coach, a basketball entrepreneur. So I want to dig into all those things with you. Let's start out by going back in time and tell us a little bit about your first experiences with the game of basketball as a kid. What made you fall in love with it?
Well, I was fortunate enough to be a coach's kid growing up. with my dad coaching girls basketball at Roncalli High School, where I eventually attended. So it's always easier to get invested and become more passionate about the game when your dad's got keys to the gym. So that's where it all started.
When you look back on that time, did your dad take you to a lot of practices? Do you remember going to practices and games from the time you were very, very young?
Yeah. I probably don't remember everything, but from what they tell me and what makes sense with my personality is I was at most of his practices and was probably more annoying than helpful at first, but was always around.
Did you have an idea? I guess maybe this probably question probably flows into you being a little bit older, but did you realize sort of how fortunate you were to be able to have the kind of gym access that you probably had, maybe compared to your friends who also like basketball, but their dad didn't have the keys to the gym? Or did you just drag those friends along with you when you went to the gym?
I think that's something probably as you mature and get older into high school age that you start to realize kind of maybe some of the privileges that you have, especially when your dad's got keys to the gym. And in going through high school, was fortunate enough to have a great high school coach, and we'd go through some leadership classes, and I think that was one of the good things that I got better at is going through high school in the later years was trying to bring more guys to the gym with me. And ultimately that's what leads to more team success, and that's what you're after.
Absolutely. When you think about your dad as a coach, what do you remember about him growing up as a basketball coach, like the style of coach that he was, maybe the style of play, maybe some things that now you look at yourself as a coach that stuck with you that you sort of incorporated into your own bag of tricks as a coach?
Probably the first word that comes to mind is competitor, and definitely thankful for his competitiveness and intensity and instilling that in myself and brother and sister who are younger. And I guess it's no surprise, like I mentioned earlier, I was lucky enough to have a great high school coach in Joe Rucks at Roncalli High School in Manitowoc. And then the coaches I played for in college, Coach Kevin Luke, who just retired, and Coach Bittner, there were some intense dudes as well. So I'm thankful for that intensity and that competitiveness, because I think that's a great trait to have, not only in basketball or sports, but really in life.
Yeah, absolutely. I think competitiveness is something that, and you know this as a coach, or you know this as a player too, when you think about teammates that you've played with, that it seems like some players just have that natural competitiveness, and others, seems like it's a lot of work as a coach to be able to draw that out of players. So as both a teammate and maybe think about it as a coach, but what are some things that maybe you've done to try to inspire people around you? And you can take this as, you know, a player with your teammate or as a coach with the players that have played for you. What are some things that you've tried to do to inspire the people around you to become more competitive? You think there's anything that you can do to sort of, I don't know if even know if teach is the right word, but just to get guys to be more competitive?
It's probably got to start just with your example. I mean, you talk about leadership and lead by example and lead vocally. So if you're not doing it yourself, like, it's hard to inspire others to do it as well. Easier to do as a player, a little harder to do as a coach, as I'm figuring out, since you're not quite on the court with them and putting in all the sweat and the workouts. But I say first example, then in terms of your communication and energy, and I think energy and enthusiasm is contagious. So whether that's as a player or a coach, if you can bring that every day, I think that helps. From a coaching standpoint, I mean, this is a question kind of been wrestling with and trying to ask different coaches for advice. So, I mean, I'd like to hear your thoughts too, but, in terms of getting that competitiveness and toughness out of players, you try to create that environment where you're competing a lot, where it's kind of win or lose type deal to try to fuel players with that. But I think it's kind of a great discussion topic in general.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think what we found over the course of doing the podcast for the last 3 years, and this is a conversation that oftentimes we have with the coaches that have been guests on the show is how do you build a competitive practice environment? Because I think that's a question that all coaches have. They always want as much competition as you possibly can have in practice to get your team to be better. And so a lot of the answers from coaches comes down to you have to have a winner and a loser in almost every drill that you do. There has to be something that's being tracked, whether, you know, you're talking about a shooting drill where, okay, yeah, we could shoot 100 shots or whatever it might be, or we're going to shoot for 15 minutes. But if you don't keep track of that, it's just not the same level of competitiveness as it is when you're tracking that. And obviously that clearly depends upon the level that you're coaching at. If you're a one-man show as a parent coaching a fifth grade recreation basketball team, your ability to chart shooting drills is a lot less than a head coach at the Division I level who has multiple staff members and managers and all kinds of people that can help, and then film and all the things that go along with that. So it does depend, I think, on the level. But having a winner and a loser in a drill is something that we've heard all the time. We've also heard from coaches that if you can track whatever it is that you want to get your players to do more of, whether that's deflections, whether that's offensive rebounds, whether that's taking charges, if you chart those things in practice, in games, you're likely to get more of it, and you're likely to get your players to compete to try to do those things. So those are the things that we've heard most often from coaches, again, kind of across levels, with the understanding that it's limited. The lower levels you go and the less coaches you have as a part of your staff, the more of a challenge that becomes. But I think, honestly, for me, when I look at it and I think about myself as a player, I think about players that I've worked with, I think about teams that I've coached, I think it comes down to that if you're measuring something, it's much more likely to improve because there's at least a benchmark and there's at least something for coaches and players to point to look at that says, hey, we're either getting better, we're getting worse, we're staying at the same level. And when you see it in front of you in a concrete way, whether that's just a piece of paper, whether that's a chart on the locker room wall, whatever it is, if players and coaches can see it, I think that adds to the competitiveness without question.
Yeah. I guess one other thought just that came to mind as you were mentioning on those points is, I guess, mixing it up depending on what kind of age group you're working with. Maybe their attention span, or some kids aren't quite as naturally competitive. One thing that I've played with in camps or group workouts is just maybe mixing up the time of a competitive drill. And maybe increasing multiple rather than doing a 4-minute shooting drill and having a winner at the end. Maybe you go a minute of certain spots or of a certain thing. So then you have kind of 4 winners. So I don't have to keep that attention span for the 4 minutes. It's more of a, all right, you won round one, these guys won round two. But I guess that's something I've had a little bit success with. I don't know if you've played with that at all.
Yeah, that's, I think, a really good one because, like you said, especially with kids today, and again, I think the younger you go, the more important that becomes. Just like if you're a teacher and you're teaching kindergarten, you better have a lot of activities planned to keep those kindergartners engaged compared to you're teaching seniors in high school. But I think for everybody, attention spans today certainly are probably less than they were 20 or 30 years ago, simply because of the way we consume media, just phones in our pocket and all that kind of stuff that goes along with it. But I do think it's a great point that when you allow for there to be more winners, or at least more opportunities for kids to win those competitive situations, it can definitely work. I think back to even when I was playing, we used to do a shooting drill where you had to go kind of around the arc and make 7 shots from 3-point range in a minute. And so you had 3 teams at your basket. One guy started in each corner and then kind of worked their way opposite around the arc. And then there was another group of 2 that were shooting free throws. And so you'd have 3 rebounders in the basket, and then you'd have 3 shooters. And so you'd have the winner of that round. So you might be competing at one end against another group of 6 players at the other end. And so you'd have the winner of that round, and then that group would get rewarded. But then it would also end up being a cumulative score. So you might shoot a total of 7 or 8 rounds, and you'd have a winner of that entire thing. But you'd also have a winner, you know, for each of those 1-minute rounds, kind of like to your point. And so it would reset. And I think that always helps. It allows you to say, I had a cold streak for this minute, but I can bounce back in the next minute. Where if it's a cumulative 10-minute shooting drill and I have a really bad minute where I miss 7 or 8 shots in a row, in my mind, I'm like, oh, I'm out of it. But when I can put that minute aside, now I can bounce back. And I think that's kind of what you're getting at, is the opportunity for kids to have success in that small range, and then everything resets and now I got to compete again, instead of it can kind of drag if things go on longer maybe than they should.
Yeah. I like that.
All right. So let's go back to you as a player. Was basketball always your main thing? Did you play other sports? Tell me a little bit about your total athletic picture, and then when you really started to focus in on basketball, or was it always basketball right from the start just because of your dad's coaching background?
Growing up, it was playing everything with my brother and with friends, basketball, football, baseball, tennis, playing outside a lot. It's really playing everything. And then not until high school, I played football throughout high school and played tennis my freshman year, but cut tennis sophomore year to senior year just with AAU, with the AAU schedule, and not wanting to miss that because basketball was my biggest passion. And I knew my goal was I wanted to play at the collegiate level and hopefully earn a scholarship. So that's probably when I got a little more specific and went down from 3 sports to 2.
What did you do as you started to realize that, hey, basketball is kind of where I want to go with this thing? What did you do as a player to improve yourself? What was the balance between you in the gym by yourself, getting shots up and working on your game versus seeking out pickup games? How did you go about getting better? How did you put together that plan for improving yourself as a player as you started to get more serious about the game?
Well, I was lucky enough to have a dad who knew what the heck he was talking about and what he was teaching, and then having a great high school coach. So just having conversations and different things that they would recommend working on. But then at the same time, there's a lot to getting in the gym on your own and getting in there with a partner and working on things. I'm 6'1", I like to say, with shoes on. And not a freak athlete by any means. So if I wanted to have the success that I wanted to have in the game of basketball, it needed to be through skill and some of those other intangibles. But it helped having a plan. And that started with my high school coach in terms of creating a progression plan along with my dad.
And so what did that look like, the progression plan? Just can you give us an idea of some of the things that you did? Did you have a quote regular workout? Like, I did this much ball handling, I did this much shooting off the dribble, I did this much shooting off the catch. What were some of the things specifically that you worked on that maybe a player today who is listening might be able to take advantage of?
Yeah, and I think it's as I matured and got higher in high school and then into college, I feel like, most good players, they work hard, but you also got to figure out how to work smart, and having a plan is a big part of that. And when guys, talking to guys nowadays, when they say they're in the gym for an hour and a half to 2 hours, the first question that pops into my mind is, what were you doing for that long? Why'd a workout take that long?
Right.
It's one thing if maybe you worked skill for 45 minutes to an hour and then played some one-on-one or two-on-two, then maybe I can see you getting up to 2 hours. But just being efficient with your time and having the plan of getting in there 45, 50 minutes, maybe an hour, working on your skill work and figuring out, all right, I want to work on ball handling for 10 minutes. I want to work on just your catch and shoot shots for 10 minutes. And then I want to touch these other areas of the game, these other skills, and want to work on developing those as well. And when you're going hard, I think you should be dog tired by the time you get to 45, 50 minutes or an hour.
Yeah, I agree with you there. It's funny. I think I've told this story on the podcast. I'm not 100% sure, but when I was in high school, I used to go to this workout club and go, and that's where I do my shooting workouts. And it's funny because I had basically from the time I was about maybe 15 or 16 until I was done with my college career, I had 2 workouts I had one that I did by myself, and it was exactly the same every single day I went to the gym. I wasn't nearly as creative maybe as you were. Plus, I didn't have the resources back in the mid to late 80s to really come up with. I didn't have YouTube to go to come out with new drills. I look at all the stuff that's out there now. I'm like, man, I wish I would have been more creative in what I did. But I had the same workout. So if I was by myself, I did workout A. And if I had a partner, I tried to get them to do workout B. And I would go in there, and each of those workouts, my individual workout probably took, it was probably about an hour and 15 minutes, maybe an hour and 20. And there was a kid that always played at a high school near me that would always be up at that same workout place. And I'd come in the gym and he'd be wandering around out by like the exercise bikes. And then he'd come in, he'd shoot some free throws. Then he'd walk over and he'd get a drink and he'd towel off. And, the whole time I'm at my basket working and, I'd get ready to leave. And he's like, oh, I've already been here. I was here an hour before you got here. I'm going to be here another hour or two. And then later you'd hear him, you come back for pickup games. I'd hear him telling guys, I was here working on my game for 3 hours. And I always used to just laugh with some of my friends. I'm like, look, I don't know what he's telling you, but I'm here at the same time he is. And he's getting up like, 1/10 of the work that I'm getting in the hour that I was putting in. And I think that's to your point. That efficiency piece is something. I mean, you can go to any gym in America and walk in there. And what do you see? You see kids, quote, shooting around. And a lot of those kids are under the mistaken impression that they're really working on their game and that they're getting better. And again, I guess it's better than sitting on your couch, but shooting around is not going to get you to the level of play that you want to attain if you're going to be a varsity basketball player or you're going to be a college player, certainly.
Yeah, completely agree.
So it's kind of it's interesting when you go and you think about yourself as a player and someone who started to take it more and more seriously and wanted to put that kind of time in. And then you kind of look around and you realize like, hey, there's a reason why I'm having some success. It's just because I'm willing to work a little bit harder maybe than the people around me. And to your point, especially when you're someone who maybe doesn't have all those natural running, jumping, athletic gifts that a lot of times we associate with high level players, I think you have to find a way to develop your skill set in such a way that enables you to have success against the players who do have those gifts. You have to just be that much more skilled in order to compete. And I know that's when I think about myself as a player, that's what I tried to become. And it sounds like you were exactly the same way. So when you think about your high school career, do you have a highlight or two that sticks out that you remember that when somebody asks you, hey, what was your high school basketball experience like? Do you have one or two things that stick out for you?
My sophomore year was our only year that we made it to state in the state of Wisconsin. Unfortunately, left on a sour note and got upset my senior year, I think, when we were the number one ranked team in our division. So I think that though probably the making it to state sophomore year, along with as our program got better and better, and thankful for the years before that, that kind of helped establish that, we got to play in some of those better tournaments. One of them was in Peoria, Illinois, the Tournament of Champions. And Finley Prep was there, a couple of those prep schools, along with a number of other schools from basically all around the Midwest, too, in terms of high school teams. And just being able to play at some of those bigger events and kind of on the different stages, those are the memories that, and probably successes that I remember the most.
Do you remember the wins or the losses more?
Probably the losses.
Yeah. that's an honest answer. That's exactly how I feel.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah. I always like to ask the question. I don't know that there's a right answer, but would you say, and I think this probably answers itself, but how much do you love to win versus hate to lose? Is there one that stands out when you hear one of those two phrases? Does one of them resonate more with you?
Our coach, I think this is where I remember getting this from, but using the phrase, just refusing to lose. And I think as a competitor, that kind of sums it up. Whatever you got to do, whatever it takes, obviously within the rules and whatnot, but just refusing to lose, that's kind of sums it up, I think, in my mind.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, like I said, for myself, I definitely remember the losses a lot more than I remember the wins. I mean, obviously there are a couple of memorable wins that you remember, but I can certainly remember all the painful losses that come, especially when you're a person that wins more than you lose. You tend to have those, you know, when the losses are less frequent, you tend to remember them a little bit better. And also I think that the sting of those, if you're a competitor, like we talked about earlier, I think those things hurt. So you had and set in mind that you wanted to play college basketball. So you're obviously a successful high school player. You're a kid who works hard. Your dad's a coach. When it comes time for you to start the recruiting process, what do you remember about that? What was it like going through it? And what was your mindset? And how do you end up at Michigan Tech?
I would say my goal always was to earn a Division I scholarship. You watch one shining moment every, March, probably April, at the end of every college season, and you want to be on that someday. I wasn't able to earn a Division I scholarship, but I had a great school in Michigan Tech who was very interested in me. It was a great fit academically, basketball-wise, and thankful for the opportunity that I had there. Ended up meeting my wife there, and now it's kind of come full circle and going to be back working there again, and I'm fired up for that.
Yeah, absolutely. When you think about obviously having Division I aspirations, which when you think about high school basketball players, there's so many players who have that in their mind that that's what they want to do. So when you were going through that process, what do you remember hearing from coaches, people that were involved in the recruiting process with you when it came to whether or not you were going to get a Division I opportunity? What were some of the things that you remember hearing from coaches in regards to that, whether it's coaches at the Division I level that maybe you reached out to, or maybe coaches at the Division II or NAI Division III level kind of talking to you about your game?
It was not big enough, not athletic enough. Those were the main two at 6'1" and average athlete. But you don't forget those things. And I mean, one of the things that I've learned, especially as I've gotten older and kind of changed roles and been in the coach's seat, is fit is so important in terms of for players in the recruiting process and just finding the right fit for you, whatever level it is. And was talking with our now head coach right now at Michigan Tech, and he was a guy who was a two-time All-American. I was fortunate enough my senior year to earn All-American honors, but he was just saying, yeah, probably by the time I was a junior or senior at the Division II level, I would have been ready to play at least a mid-major Division I. But it's that experience you get early, maybe being able to play early, and how you develop as a player from that, that if he goes to a Division I mid-major right away, maybe he doesn't turn out to be the player he was after the 4 years. There's certain factors that contribute to that. And I thought that was a great point. So it just kind of goes to fit and kind of what your situation
is. Yeah, absolutely. I think that the fit is really important, and trying to figure that out, where you should be. And again, we all know that most kids that you tend to want to reach, and you tend to want to stretch yourself and say, hey, maybe I can play at this level, even though it seems like most everybody, the consensus is that I should be at another level. And now when you talk about a player developing within, let's say, as a Division II player, as an NAIA player, a Division III player, and then eventually by the time you're an upperclassman, would you be capable of playing at that higher level? And in many cases, again, if you put the time in your game and you've worked on it, I think there's no doubt that there's tons of players that are at whatever level they are that could probably play a level up, especially by the time they're a junior or a senior. And yet, in a lot of cases, what role you play at a school at a higher level may not be as much fun. You may not get as much of an opportunity to have the ball in your hands. And there's something to be said for that. Like, it's one thing to be out on the floor and you play 15 minutes a game at one level, and maybe you're just strictly a role player. And at a lower level, you can be the player with the ball in their hands, or you can be the player that gets to take more shots and just be involved. And so I think your point is really well taken, that you have to find the right fit. So when you thought Michigan Tech was the right place for you, what was it about Michigan Tech? And then as you got in there, how did you find, or what did you find to be the things that you loved about being there?
So the academics were probably one of those at the top of the list. Wanted to go to a school that could win. Because I guess as we were talking about earlier, as a competitor, you want to win and you want to be part of a winning program, especially if you have kind of throughout your early career. So those were two big ones. And then one of the byproducts of my dad being the coach and working at the high school is I was a part of that Roncalli community since I was 1 year old. So having a strong tie and community sense during the high school years, that was something that was important to me. And just getting on campus and visiting just got the sense of a really tight-knit community. Michigan Tech's in a unique place in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Maybe some listeners are, what's the Upper Peninsula of Michigan? But it's the part right above Wisconsin. But it gets tons of snow and it's a little more remote up here, but you kind of figure things out and people bond together with some of that remoteness and community sense.
All right, so I got to ask you, this is my Upper Peninsula of Michigan question. Have you been to Isle Royale National Park?
Oh, I haven't.
Oh man, you got to get there, man. Have you been to Copper Harbor?
Yes, been to Copper Harbor. Have you been to Isle Royale?
I have. We went. My family and I went. Now let me think. How many years it's been? It's been quite a few. Probably, I would bet 5 or 6 years probably since we went. But we're from Cleveland, so we drove from Cleveland up through the Upper Peninsula and parked our car at Copper Harbor, took the ferry all the way across Lake Superior to, I guess it's about 12 miles from the Canadian border, got off and stayed in, I don't know, whatever lodging that they had there, they were like little cabins, and then did some hiking. Did not see a wolf while we were there, but did see a moose finally. The kids were super excited. We almost ran into a moose on the trail. So for any of our listeners that are out there, I think it's probably one of the least visited national parks because you do have to take like a 3.5-hour ferry from the Upper Peninsula, which is hard to get to in and of itself.
Yeah.
And anyway, so if you get a chance, I'd highly recommend it. It's great. I loved it.
Yeah. My wife just brought that up a couple of weeks ago. She's like, especially with going back up there, I think this summer is maybe the time. So
There you go. Well, if you do, you're gonna enjoy it without question. All right. So tell us a little bit about your playing career at Michigan Tech. What it was like. What you enjoyed about it.
Definitely enjoyed the winning season. 3 out of the 4 years, we made the NCAA tournament. The farthest we made it was the Sweet 16. D2 is a little different than the D1 and D3 national tournament in terms of there's 8 regions of 8. So a little different than D1 and D2 or D3. But we had a lot of success, had great coaches to learn from. It's a good place to be. I guess that's why I'm back.
Exactly. What's your favorite memory?
Favorite memory would probably be making it to the Sweet 16 my junior year. We had an upset in the second round. I don't think a lot of people would have picked us to win that one, but our whole team in general, Michigan Tech isn't known as having the most athletic dudes in the world. It's more so beating guys, being sound, being fundamental, toughness, and obviously you got to have enough players to win games. So we got guys who got talent and some athleticism, but that round 2 win to get to the Sweet 16 was probably the most memorable.
Yeah, it's very cool. I mean, I think competing in the NCAA tournament, no matter what level you get an opportunity to do that at, is something special because – not everybody gets to go there, and the opportunity to be able to compete for a national championship again is something that even if you're a college player, not every college player gets the opportunity to experience that. I know I came up 1 point short when I was a freshman and thought, oh, I got plenty of years left to be able to be able to get there, and never came as close as that to be able to get back. And so, like you said, you dream of growing up and being able to think about one shining moment and playing in the tournament and making a basket and somehow making it on that thing. And to not get an opportunity to do it was definitely probably one of the biggest, I don't know, disappointments is probably the wrong way to put it. But you just wish that having had the experience that you could have gotten the full boat and gone in and played in the NCAA tournament. So I'm sure for you it was special to be able to do that. At this point, as you're wrapping up your college playing career, what's on your mind from that point? Obviously, you've been a player for pretty much your entire life. So are you thinking about, hey, I might have an opportunity to play overseas? Was that something that you had your eye on? Was it something that kind of came out of nowhere? Were you already thinking about coaching? Were you thinking about getting into a quote unquote real job? Where was your mindset at as you were finishing up at Michigan Tech?
It really wasn't on the radar probably till towards the end of junior year when started getting some messages or letters from agents. But then in having a good senior year, towards the end, definitely something that talked about with the coaches and the year, the player in the year in our league the prior year when I was a junior had just went over to Spain. So there was a couple of guys in our league who had went over and played in Europe. So I was aware of that, and that kind of helped the process and thinking through and kind of measuring yourself against certain guys. And coaches kind of helped make that decision, and then started reaching out and getting different advice in terms of kind of figuring out an agent, but explored those waters. And I guess kind of like college, realized that it would be a pretty good fit, and was fortunate enough to play 1 year over in Spain. And then unfortunately dealt with some more injuries and called her quits probably a year or two before I would have liked to at the minimum, but it was a great experience.
All right. So give us, well, let me ask you this. This is my standard question. What was the craziest European basketball story that you had from your year over there? And with the caveat, you have to keep it PG.
Craziest. I guess the first 2 days were a little bit of a shock. So the first day flying in, first international flight, arrive, it's 7-hour difference between, I guess, Midwest and Spain, and get in, our trainer picks me up from the airport, and we drive straight to a restaurant. And where I played was a city called A Coruña in the northwest corner of Spain. So right on the water there, and known for their seafood. And so the first restaurant we go to, he orders octopus, or pupo as they know it, and which I guess was, especially in that region, really a delicacy. And so first meal after coming off a 10-hour plane ride was octopus, which was a new experience for me. And then the second day we go for lunch, and I say, sure, I'll take fish. And the fish comes out, I mean, it was the whole freaking fish with the eyes still in the sockets. And so those were two experiences right away that was a little bit of a shock, a little bit of different culture.
You were pretty fast looking for some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches or a hamburger, right?
That's right. Or some cheese curds from Wisconsin.
Yeah, there you go. That's it. You're trying to find yourself some Kringle.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I think it's just it's funny when you think about that experience. And I'm sure that just the opportunity to go over there for 1 year again, when you're young and you have the ability to go and play basketball and be paid for it and just have the experience of living overseas, I'm sure was tremendously, tremendously valuable for you. So the injuries cut it short, and then it's time to come back home. What's the thought process on coaching? Was it something that was always on your mind from the time you were little because your dad was a coach and you thought, hey, I'm always, you know, coaching is going to be something that eventually I can see myself getting into? Or was it more kind of, hey, I got done playing. I still love the game. I want to be involved in it. Maybe now it's time for me to really look at this coaching thing. Which one of those paths maybe better described you?
I guess reflecting on it, it probably always was kind of in the back of my mind, just kind of with my upbringing and family. But the way it ended, I was trying to go back for the second year of my contract. I was rehabbing and doing physical therapy and just other aches and pains and past injuries coming up. So it was kind of a later summer, last minute decision to call it quits. And at that point, I really wasn't sure what I was going to be doing. My expectation was I'd be back in Spain. And at that point, Coach Luke at Michigan Tech and Coach Bittner, are now head coach at Michigan Tech, put out the offer that, hey, if you want to start some master's classes and basically come here as a assistant coach, kind of our second assistant, that's open for you. And probably the best part of that situation is we had that trust built up. As I've been getting older, realizing how important trust is, whether you're trying to find a job or really dealing with anybody. But that trust factor was there, so they were able to give me a lot of responsibility. So I think that responsibility that they gave me in year one, I think excited me with the coaching and being able to get my hands in a lot of part of the job that a coach has. And I think from there, I kind of knew this is what I want to do.
What part of coaching did you like best right away? Like, what was something that you took to immediately? Was it player development? Did you like scouting? Was it the X's and O's piece of it? Which piece of it did you immediately say, oh, this, man, I love this part of coaching?
I like most of it in general. Maybe some of the time it takes to do scouting reports, I wish it didn't take quite as long, but would probably have to say player development. That would probably be based off of kind of what I needed to do as a player to have success. Player development's been a passion, and I think it's a big time difference maker. And I mean, in my 5 years of coaching now, I've been able to witness it at different places that player development and players getting in the gym on a daily basis, whether it was at UW Oshkosh, when we probably contributed that as the factor that put us over the edge in terms of winning a national championship there, or being able to talk to different coaches. I've been able to go to different places. Player development and guys getting in the gym and developing not only the off season, but over the course of a year, can turn you into a championship team or get you over that hump.
Yeah, I think that there's no doubt. It's something that I think that, I mean, it's always been prevalent, I think, to some degree, but I would say probably in the last 5 years especially, I think the amount of knowledge around player development and just the number of people that are sharing great information that are enabling coaches at all levels to be able to step up and become better with their player development, plus the fact that at all levels, they've been able to sort of relax the restrictions on how much player development time that coaches can have with their players. And I think that's opened up the ability for coaches at both the high school and the college level to have more time with their players. And that's to say nothing of, which we'll talk about here with you in a second, that's to say nothing of the individual private coaches who, with most players, in a lot of ways, there's so many players now that are working with a private skills trainer or a private skills coach to help them develop their game. And so I think it's no surprise that player development, if you do it well, can definitely be a game changer for a program, whether you're talking about at the high school or college level. So what are some things that you've learned over your time at the various places that you've been that are important for player development? If you want to put together, let's just say you're talking to a high school coach and that high school coach says, hey, I want to develop a really good player development program. What are some things that, or advice that you would give them when it comes to that?
Probably the top thing would be just creating a plan or be in communication with your guys and have discussion. Because I think having that plan needs to be based out of what do you do offensively, or what are the things, or what are the shots that each individual player is going to get in games. I mean, that's why you try to develop yourself so you can become a better player in games. So kind of having that plan, thinking through, visualizing certain situations, that's kind of got to be the core of your development.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I think that's something that when you think about working with individual players, and I haven't done as much of that recently since I started the podcast, which I guess isn't recent anymore. It's been 3 years since I really have kind of scaled back on the amount of training that I was doing. But now I have a son who's a freshman, so I've kind of been working. My training has kind of been with him. And one of the things that I'm constantly trying to do is I watch when he plays in a game or a scrimmage or a summer league, and I try to look at, okay, what are the things that he's doing in games, and then how can I translate that into the time that we spend together working on his game? And I think that's so important when you think about, as a coach, trying to figure out, okay, well, what does this player, what do I need them to do in a game? And then how can I design skill work that helps them to improve things that they're actually going to do? Because we all know that you can see lots of people doing crazy drills and different things that you look at it and you say, how can that really help a player to get better in the role that they have on their given team? And obviously everybody wants to. The reason, part of the reason why you go and work on your game is so you can expand it and expand your role with your team. But still, you have to be able to do game style things. And I think if you don't have a plan, which is your point, then you're going to be in trouble. You're just going to end up not being as efficient, which is what we talked about earlier, how important that efficiency is in really being able to do the things that you're going to do in a game.
Hey, hoopheads, we all hate ankle sprains, and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com/teampricing to learn more. That's ARYSE.com.
I think I've heard some coaches talking about be good at the things that happen the most.
Right.
And probably what was a great, like, kind of aha moment was the going to Dallas and just being around that every day and hearing. So the former player development coach, Mike Procopio, I heard him talk about, like, what really, when you think about the NBA, there's what, 2 to 3 guys on each team that are shooting maybe over 8 to 10 shots a game. So that's only, I forget what he said, it's maybe 10, 15, 20% of the league.
If that. Right. I don't think it's that high. He's like, yeah. I think he said when he was on with us, I want to say he said something like there was like, there's 40 guys or 50 guys that was some number to that point where there's this many guys who matter in terms of those guys are going to get plays run for them. Those guys are going to get to have the ball in their hands. And then his other big statement that he shares and he puts it everywhere and he said it on our podcast is, look, just dominate simple. Be good at the things that are very simple. And I think that is exactly what you're talking about. So before you expound on that, just let people know what, when you said you're in Dallas, let people know what you exactly mean. You were with the Mavericks. So just tell them what you had an opportunity to do there with the Dallas Mavericks.
So the Mavericks, this past year was different with COVID, but they have one of the biggest intern programs, player development intern programs in the league. They've been bringing 12 guys in as interns the last handful of years. So I had the opportunity to go there as one of the player development interns 2 years ago, was there in person. This past year it was working remote, just to limit personnel in the facility. But be around the team every day, be at practice, doing different video analytics work, being a part of the scout team, then working with guys pre-practice, post-practice. So that was the opportunity I had in Dallas, and it was a heck of a learning experience, and thankful for all the relationships and learning opportunities that I had there.
What's something that was unique to the NBA experience compared to some of the other experiences that you've had? Obviously, the budgets are bigger. The players are a little bit wealthier. They're a little bit bigger, a little bit faster, a little bit stronger. But just what's something unique that maybe was different there with the Mavericks, something that stands out to you as, hey, this experience was really cool. It's something that I'm not sure I would get at any other level of the game.
I guess one of the nice parts is it's strictly basketball. As a college coach, you got to deal with some of the, I guess, extracurricular, I don't want this to sound wrong, but like some of the academic portion or administration or right. Different elements of the game. So it was kind of nice just dealing with strictly basketball if you're super passionate about that, I guess like I am. But in general, I guess just going back to like you laid out the stats for and what Procoprio talks about is keeping the game simple and working on the in-game skills that you're going to get as an individual and trying to get really good what you're pretty good at. Yes, still working on some of your weaknesses, but for the most part, like you were talking about, Mike, doing the same routine almost every day. Maybe you mix it up once in a while, but it's not that complicated when you really think about it. And when you're trying to improve or play a certain role within a team, or whether you're trying to find a role within a team, it can be simple.
What did you notice about the mentality of an NBA player? What makes them different from a preparation standpoint and attention to detail standpoint? And obviously there are, just like there is at any level of basketball, there are varying degrees of how guys handle their business. But just in general, how would you describe the mentality of NBA players when it comes to the player development process and them improving and working on their game, just from a mental standpoint of how they go about doing that? Obviously, one thing is, again, being repetitive and paying attention. But just what was your experience with their mentality when it came to trying to get better?
You notice pretty quickly that all of them are probably the top 1% of competitiveness. I know a lot of people don't care for the whining that goes on. But I think part of that is these guys are just so competitive that like it's going against their complete nature to not argue some of these calls in the NBA. So I guess the competitiveness would be one part of it, but then just learning how to be professionals when that's your job, and it's not to that level, but I experienced a little bit of that playing when that's your job, that's your career, and all you have to worry about is getting better at the game of basketball along with your body. It makes things a little easier, and fortunate to be able to do it, but they take it seriously and they put in the hours like anybody else does in a normal job. I know they're getting to play a game, but it's taken very seriously.
How does that relate to the age of the players? Because you think about guys coming in at far younger ages than they would have, whatever, 20 years ago. And so you got a lot of kids coming in after their freshman year of college. So you got a lot of 19, 20, 21-year-old guys that are in there making a lot of money for the first time in their life. What do teams have in place, or what did the Mavs have in place to sort of help those players, not only with their basketball development, but just their development as human beings when it comes to being able to handle all the things that go along with being a professional basketball player?
I'm sure that I don't know all of it, of what the Mavs have in place or other NBA teams have in place, but it more so dealt with the coaches on a daily basis, working with the players. But I think the one thing is just in terms of your coaching staff and just listening to the conversations that you have every day with players. It's not just about hoops or improving their skills. It's about how are things going, or are there things we can help you with? And the one thing you do notice, there's a lot of staff members along with an NBA organization, and a lot of people there to help players, and especially younger players, become better professionals and help them deal with certain situations. Like every team now has a sports psychologist. So talking with them and helping them figure things out and allow them to have the most success that they can have. They have all the different people in place.
When you're in the midst of the season, obviously the guys who are playing, and especially when you think about this year with it being a condensed schedule and, you know, and even in normal years, the amount of practice time that NBA teams are getting during the season is fairly minimal. And yet there's guys at the back end of the roster who aren't playing nearly as much as I'm sure they would obviously like to. And so they're not getting any run on the floor. So in order for them to stay sharp and be able to compete and get an opportunity to continue to improve and get better without that formal team practice time, how do teams like the Mavericks, how do they go about making sure that they keep those guys at the back end of the roster engaged? It's one thing, you know, you're working with Luka and he's doing his thing and he's one of the best players in the world and he's playing 40 minutes every night or 35 minutes every night during the regular season. But what about these guys that are sort of towards the back end of it? How did those player development interns like yourself, what role did you guys play with those players, maybe guys who are at the back end of the roster?
We've played a lot of 5-on-5, actually. Boban, his reputation is correct. He's probably one of the nicest human beings I've ever met in my life. But guys like Boban or other guys towards the end of the bench that maybe were younger guys weren't getting as much playing time, just getting up and down, playing 5-on-5, would incorporate some 1-on-1 at the end of workouts just to keep their cardio up. But they're also doing, some wind sprints or down and backs, different ladder stuff. And it's impressive when you see a guy like JJ Barea 2 years ago and you realize like how professional he is. And it's not a surprise that the amount of success that he had in his career when a guy 30 some years old, not getting much tick, but he knows at times he's got this certain role to bring a spark and get the team going. Maybe if the energy is down in a certain game, that just the way he handles himself and takes care of his body and still gets cardio in, running up and down. And that part was really impressive.
Was there a particular player while you were there that you built maybe a stronger relationship with than some of the other guys on the roster? Was there one guy that stood out that you really connected with?
It was pretty hard not to connect with Boban just because the nice a guy he was. One of our interns basically played him in 1-on-1 every single day of the season. Maybe one of the other guys that I'd say became a little closer to was Jalen Brunson, just because he's a heck of a worker. He had a heck of a year this year in his third year. But part of that was just with my size as well. We would do some 1-on-1 stuff, and he actually broke my rib in one of our games when
nice.
I was trying to give him a token look defensively. But he's a great guy and heck of a player.
What about on the coaching staff side? Was there somebody that kind of took you under their wing that was part of the, you know, the main coaching staff, so to speak?
Our really on the court boss was Peter Patton, the shooting coach for the Mavericks. But really, him and God Sham God were kind of the main two player development coaches with the team 2 years ago when we were there. So probably became closest with him as we kind of reported to him every day and also had some good conversations. I think he was kind of known as a shooter in his day, and it was always fun chatting with him, and like we related to each other pretty well in that regard.
Was there something that you learned during your time with the Mavericks that was a revelation, something that you hadn't yet realized in your coaching journey that has helped you in your time since then to become a better coach?
I don't know if it was maybe a true revelation, but maybe two simpler things that just really stuck out as they were emphasized. I guess one was offensively, just in terms of talking about and having the discipline with spacing. NBA teams are great at that. And I think that's starting to trickle down more in terms of holding that to a high standard in terms of spacing on the floor offensively and the benefits it gives you, everybody on your team. And then the other part would be the communication. One thing that I loved and will definitely be using in the future is we had basically a communication and kind of like a vocabulary sheet to make sure everybody's on the same page defensively. This is the word we use when we're in gap help. This is the word we use when you're the weak side, like say like a MIG term, or there's a word we use for if a ball screen's coming, you're just saying this word. If he screens your right shoulder, we're just saying right, because that indicates the shoulder they're coming to screen you on. But it just laid it out, made it less confusing, and just kind of simplifying the communication and making sure everybody's on the same page. That I thought that was awesome.
Yeah, I've said this a bunch of times on the pod with different coaches. I think that's one of the things that I'm probably the worst at as a coach and have been for almost my entire career. I don't know what this says about me that I've never really improved it, but the ability to just kind of condense things down to a short word or a phrase, I'm always the person that likes to give kind of the long explanation of, hey, I want you to do da-da-da-da-da-da, and I just kind of keep talking instead of saying, hey, sprint the lane. Like, I always want to give this big, long explanation. I want to do it every single time. And I've never been good about kind of coming up with, as you just said, those keywords or phrases that when you say this one word or this one phrase, everybody knows exactly what it means. And it just kind of it makes things so much easier to be able to communicate when you have to teach it and explain it one time. Or again, you get it ingrained in your players, and then all of a sudden it just comes where I just have to say this one thing, and a whole bunch of things within that happen as a result of that one word or that one phrase. So I think that's a really good takeaway that you were able to pick up. And for any coaches that are out there, I think if you can incorporate that into what you do, you're going to end up a lot better off. And I think that's a good insight that you were able to get from your time with the Mavs. Last Mavs question. Mm-hmm. Luka, when you guys got together and got an opportunity to watch him do the things that he does, what did you guys as interns, what did you talk about that you're like, man, we're watching this guy and he's just unbelievable in this way? What were the things that stood out for you about him that makes him such a special player?
The first thing is definitely just his IQ, just how intelligent of a player he is. And I know Coach Carlisle has talked about it and other assistants have talked about it in different interviews, but just how heady he is and how he knows where everybody's going to be on his terms of his teammates, but also defensively, and just how he can anticipate everything. And as a coach, I guess taking something away from that, when you got smart players like that, I know there's probably not going to be many more Lukas, but having discussions with them and asking their thoughts or what are you seeing, what are you reading, just kind of having some of that dialogue. And I think that'll probably help the relationship, but kind of also help you as a coach and your team. But the second thing, you don't really realize how big he is and just how big he is and how that can impact. I mean, he's a great rebounder and just the impact that has and all of the facets of the game.
Yeah, I think his size, to your point, you don't always necessarily notice it. I think when I notice it is as he gets to the basket and he's just able to bump guys out of the way, because obviously he's not the quickest guy in the NBA, and yet he can get where he wants to go because he just has to get a slight angle on a guy, and then it's a little hip bump or a bang of the shoulder, and all of a sudden that guy that's in front of him or right on the side of him is completely out of the play in terms of being able to disrupt his shot. And, you know, that goes to size, it goes to strength, and it's just something that understanding how to use your body as a player. There are some guys who do it really, really well, and then there are other guys who struggle with it. I think it's similar to being a player. Like we all, I mean, I know James Harden hunts fouls, and I'm not a James Harden fan, but the guy, and I know you know the same thing from playing with guys on the playground or playing against players. There are just some players that understand how to draw fouls. It's just they just have a knack for it, and I just don't think that it's something that you can. I just don't think it's something that's easy to teach. And I think players who use their body well, the way Luka does, I think it's really hard to teach that. Some guys just seem to have a knack for it. And that's one of the things when I watch him, I mean, in addition to, as you said, the basketball IQ and the ability to pass and read the floor. But I think that ability to have strength going to the basket and just be able to use little subtle bumps that, again, are not going to be called offensive fouls. It's not like he's plowing guys over. It's just a little hip check here or a little dip of the shoulder there. And it creates all the space that he needs and then be able to finish. And that's something that from the moment he came into the league that he's had. And I guess you probably developed that from being a kid who's 14, 15 years old playing against adults over in Europe. Yeah, you better learn those tricks of the trade or you're going to be in trouble fast.
Yeah. And maybe that would be a third thing that something that was really impressive. Luka does it, but all the smaller guards in the NBA, how well they use their body and kind of if there's somewhat of advantage, being able to take that step into a guy, either cut off or get into him, even if they're 6'10", 6'11", 7-footers, how they can use their body, get into him, cut off angles to then be able to create space to finish. That was really impressive and kind of eye-opening to see that.
It totally is. And I think when you watch the NBA game and you compare that to the high school game or the college game, and you think about how big and fast and athletic players are on an NBA floor, and yet because the players offensively are so skilled and the spacing is so good and the ability to shoot is so good, the NBA floor looks like it has so much more space on it than a high school court. It's just, it's incredible. When you go watch a high school game, it seems like there's six players in the lane at all times. And that's even when a team is running a five out. It just seems like there's always a body in the way when a player tries to drive. And in the NBA, it's just the spacing. And again, it goes back to the skill, the coaching and the teaching and everything that goes along with it. But it's amazing how the game has evolved and how important the spacing piece of it. As you said, it starts with the NBA and now that's slowly trickling down to all levels of the game without question.
Yeah. And I guess that kind of helped confirmed in terms of future teachings when dealing with teams or offensively talking spacing, then probably talking movement and just being able to play drive and kick without screens and then incorporating screens in there, but just kind of using that as progression. Because I think a lot of players they don't have a good feel. They don't have a good feel of how to play and how to move without the basketball and how to space and read things. So I think kind of that progression of let's talk about spacing. All right, let's talk about cutting, driving, kicking, playing off that, and then talking about playing off screens. I feel like that's kind of a good progression to develop a better feel and get your players how to play the game better.
What's your mindset in terms of how to teach that? As a college coach, what are some ways that you can help kids to better understand passing, cutting? Is it mostly through small-sided games and three-on-three and just kind of letting them experiment and then going back and analyzing and looking at what they're doing? Is it putting certain reads in place? How do you go about getting kids to be able to see how to move without the ball? Because we know that most of the training that goes on with kids at the high school level below is they have the ball in their hands and there's not many trainers out there working on, okay, here's how you use a screen or here's how you come off. And you know, when you're the screen or here's how you roll and how you make the read about what you do. And so in your mind, how do you teach kids to play without the ball and make some of those reads that are going to help your offense function better when you have players who are better at reading the floor?
From my experience and I guess what I've been studying, I guess that was a benefit of the pandemic, is a lot of people have a lot more time, a lot more coaches clinics, so you're able to learn a lot more too.
Right.
But playing those small sided games, like you mentioned, whether it be 3x3, 2x2, 4v4, and just kind of talking those teaching points, I mean, giving certain constraints, but then off of that, kind of reverse engineering that, and all right, in some of our skill breakdown, we talked about this in our small games. Now let's work these kind of specific movements, or let's work catching off this way with certain footwork. Like, footwork is huge. Footwork is what basically allowed me to be the player that I was in terms of attention to detail and footwork, and kind of reverse going small games, reverse engineering it. This is how we can help develop it going back to the small games and kind of building it out from there.
So, and in terms of being able to build that footwork base and the skill development piece of it, not only have you worked as a coach at the college level, you've worked as an intern with the Mavericks, but you also developed your own private basketball business. Tell us a little bit about that, why you decided to start it, what some of the things are that you did with it and hope to maybe do with it at some point in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I probably started it since I don't sit still very well. just this past year with COVID and doing remote work, basically part-time remote work for the Mavs this past year, I had a lot of time on my hands. And I've always talked about it, whether it be with Michigan Tech coaches or talking with my dad about kind of developing videos in terms of skill development. And so the idea kind of stemmed from there and created videos. And like we kind of keep going back to over the course of this discussion, talking about having a plan is working smart is just as important as working hard, and kind of creating a progression plan for players. And eventually it's evolved into kind of a 3 or 4 tier plan. You have your tier 1 plan for middle school, is your tier 2 plan for high schoolers, tier 3 for college, and then tier 4 for kind of professional level players. And creating that progression plan along with the corresponding videos of how to work a skill and maybe why we're working that skill, along with a demo of that. And that's kind of what the player development website that's been created has amounted to.
And what do you see? Is that something that you see being able to continue to grow, and you're going to continue to try to develop it as you – it's today. Today's June 23rd, and you were officially announced as an assistant coach back again at Michigan Tech, which we'll talk about in a second how that came to be. But – do you see this being something that you're going to continue to do moving forward to try to continue to build that part of what you're doing to build that business out?
The working in the team setting, and especially now that I got the opportunity to go back to Michigan Tech, that's my goal, and that's what I love, being a part of the team setting. I love working with individuals and small groups and working with kids who are passionate about getting better. So I guess with kind of that said, I'm hoping this is just a side gig that I'll continue to add to in the off season when the duties are a little lightened with the team and the program, and continuing to build that out. But yeah, right now it's got a handful or so of high school coaches using it for their team as their off season development plan. And I'd like to continue growing that, and I hope coaches and players and teams can benefit from it.
Yeah, it's very cool that you've taken the time to put that stuff together and with your connections and the people that you've met in the game to be able to get it out in front of them. And it's another way, again, to sort of expand your ability to have an impact on the game of basketball, which sort of that goes along with the mission that we've had with the podcast, is to be able to hopefully have a positive impact with people who listen to our show, with the guests that come on and share their insights. And it's been a fun part of the journey. And I'm sure that building that for you it was really enjoyable to go and put everything down on paper and be able to build the website and all those things. And as you said, if you're a person that doesn't like to sit around, and I can certainly relate to that, you know, you always want to get something going and have at it and try to grow it. So it's exciting that you were able to get that started, and I'm sure you'll continue to have success with it. Let's move into sort of our final chapter here, which begins and ends, I guess, at this point today with the announcement that you're going to go back to Michigan Tech as an assistant coach. So tell us how that came to pass and then what you're excited about moving forward with this opportunity.
Yeah, I guess first off, I just think it's awesome too what you guys have done in growing the Hoopshead pod and how it's expanded. And I enjoy listening to your guys' stuff. So I just want to say that first off. But
thank you. Thanks for the kind words. We appreciate it. It's always nice to know that there's people out there listening. So it means a lot. It means a lot to us. You know, sometimes you feel like you're talking to the mic and, you know, you hope there's people out there listening, but it's always nice to hear from anybody, whether it's a guest or, you know, when people share something on social media or they reach out to us via email and just say, hey, we enjoy what you're doing. It makes a huge difference, and it's really something that inspires us to keep going. So thank you for those kind words, and go ahead and continue.
Yeah, for sure. Drew a blank for a second. So kind of how the Michigan Tech gig became to be is our longtime head coach, Kevin Luke, retired a couple months ago. He was at Michigan Tech for like 25, 27 years as the head coach and assistant before that. And our assistant coach, who's been here the last 10, 12 years, who kind of recruited me as a player, the athletic department kind of moved him over a seat, rightfully so. He's now the head coach, and the assistant position opened up. And just kind of with the way things were, with the state of things with the Mavs and that internship and looking for full-time opportunities, this was great timing. And I would say my goal still, and I've talked with Coach Bittner about this, is to eventually get back to the NBA, because I enjoyed that. I thought that was a pretty good fit for me. But as long as things go well, hopefully Coach Bittner is the head coach at Michigan Tech for another 25 years. So I want to become a head coach eventually, but I'm really excited to come back to Michigan Tech. And we've talked about a place that I love. It's a unique place. And just excited to work with the guys and have that team setting again and be with the players on a daily basis.
Absolutely. All right, let's wrap it up with a two-part question. First part is, when you look ahead over the next year, what do you see as your biggest professional challenge? And then two, when you think about what you get to do day in and day out, what's your biggest joy about being a basketball coach, and especially now going back again to your alma mater for a second time? So your biggest challenge, your biggest joy?
Biggest challenge. So right now I've been doing a lot of recruiting, which I haven't been doing for quite a while. And I guess it's just more the uncomfortableness with something new. I think I should be fine at it, but it's the new experience. So I guess short term for this next few months and year, I would say just kind of going through the recruiting process and developing relationships with players. And I guess just trying to think of the serving kind of mentality and doing this for them and not feeling like trying to sell them on something, making sure it's a good fit for them. So I guess that's that new experience of recruiting may be my biggest challenge, at least that I'm thinking about right now. In terms of the most rewarding aspect of it, I just really enjoy working with the players and I guess one, seeing them improve on the court and being able to see that translate to the game. That's one of the benefits of working in a team setting is you get to see that direct translation and see their happiness and success right there. But then just being able to establish those better relationships and develop those lifelong relationships, like in coming back to Michigan Tech for me, like I had with our head coach here who just retired and now our new head coach. It's those relationships last a lifetime. So that's always special.
Yeah, those are two great answers. I think that anytime you're faced with a new challenge and you've kind of been off the recruiting trail now for a couple of years, so you're getting back into that. And then the greatest joy, as you said, building those relationships and having an opportunity to have your players not only have success on the floor, but have success off the floor. I think that's what, when we start thinking about what coaching is all about, it's the ability to be able to use something that we love, the game of basketball, to be able to have a positive impact on the young people's lives that we get a chance to interact with as coaches. And to me, there's nothing more valuable than that. So I couldn't agree with you more on that. Ben, just want to say thanks to you personally for taking the time to jump on and share with our audience. It's been really great to have you as a guest. We thank Casey Korn, who reached out to us and said, hey, you guys should really have Ben on the show. And I have to say, Casey, you were 100% right. So thank you. And Ben, it was terrific to be able to have this conversation with you. So thank you. And to everyone out there, we appreciate you listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.